All right. Our next speaker, as we heard earlier this morning, it was going to be John Monday talking about Salt Range in Pakistan, but he was not able to make it, and so Jim Buchholz is filling in, and he was going to talk about different philosophies of science and how that affects your faith and worldview. All right, Jim.
So I'm sorry if you were here for Monday, speaking on Monday. He got sick and couldn't speak on Monday, so I'm replacing Monday this Monday morning. His name's Monday. All right. So so I was asked at the kind of last minute earlier at the conference came up to me when Monday got sick if I'd replace today. So hopefully I will still pique your interest on this. It is a general talk. I am a physical scientist, so this is my PhD is in astrophysics. So this is this is the way I think compared to if other of you are outside of physical science, you may have different worldviews. Well, of course, there's a bunch of different worldviews. Okay, so abstract. There's basically two predominant views if you wanted to break down how people feel about philosophy of science, how science should be done. They're often referred to as the puzzle piece and the intermittent solution. Okay, and most people fall in one of these two categories of how they view science. Okay, so let me give you an informal definition. Puzzle piece, also referred to as treasure chest, might have as treasure chest philosophy of science, might go something like this. Every time we find an answer to a fundamental question in science, we have another piece of the puzzle of nature. Each piece has a valued entry in the realm of the whole puzzle. Likewise, the term treasure chest is often preferred because it has intrinsic implications of world in the word treasure. We found another piece of the treasure, okay, in this treasure chest of nature. All right, the other competing philosophy that most people tend to fall into, other than this, these are kind of the two competing ones, is often referred to as the intermediate solution philosophy of science. And it goes something like this. Expect every time you find a fundamental question in science, expect it to be replaced with something better later. Okay? Every solution to a fundamental problem in nature is an intermediate solution. Understanding nature will continue to get better, deeper, and closer to the truth. Do not be stunned by entire paradigm shifts in scientific explanations of nature. Expect them. Yeah. So those tend to be two broadly different views. All right, so in my outline here, I'm going to start off with Hurley Putnam. He passed away last year. He's literally, his title is, he was a Harvard professor, retired right around 2000, I think, but kept publishing books and passed away last year. And he speaks about these two different views. Very eloquently, very good job of doing it, very explains it very well. And he'll use all those same terms. I use intermediate solution, treasure chest, puzzle piece. And he said in a BBC interview once, and this kind of stunned me a little bit, but he said in a BBC interview that somewhere around 90 years ago, there was a paradigm shift, and what has taken over is the intermediate solution philosophy. He goes, prior to 90 years ago, it was predominantly science was done. Most scientists were treasure chests or puzzle piece. And there was this shift. Now, his title at Harvard was philosopher of science. He was a professor of philosopher of science, of philosophy of science. And what kind of caught me off guard with that is that is not my own personal experience. It is not what I've come across. They're all, you know, my years of grad school and then postdoc and teaching and everything, I would say that shift has never taken place, which often makes me think the people in the world that are in the world of philosophy science and the people actually in the world of science are not on the same page if the philosopher of science think that there's been this huge shift. As a good example, my own... I want to go back here. As a good example, on my own PhD committee, one of my advisors, I remember having this lunch, sitting down with him on the campus, and he was talking about this great article in the LA Times. And he goes, normally I don't like the LA Times. You know, I mean, the New York Times has much better science art. Every Tuesday, New York Times has new science art. It's not very good. But the LA Times had one of the best articles on science I ever saw. And the name of the article was The End of Science. That was the name of the article. And he bragged about it because he was a puzzle piece philosopher. And that's most people I've run to are not Aramean Solution. They're puzzle piece. And puzzle piece leans or leads toward the end of science. And I heard this going clear. When I was in grad school in physics, I heard so many times from other grad students and philosophers, and this was, I was starting at Texas A&M, then went to UCR. Texas A&M was my master's, UCR was my PhD. And I kept hearing this wherever I went. Boy, once we find the bottom quark, once we find the top quark, and once we find the Higgs particle, end of science, we're done. It's all tweaking. It's all tweaking technology and fine-tuning. We have found all the fundamental things. And this was actually a discussion I had that day with one of my own advisors on my PhD committee at that lunch. He was saying those exact same things. He was saying, and this was before the Higgs was discovered, as you know, the Higgs particle's now, but they've all been discovered now. And the Higgs particle was discovered about 3 years ago. And this was prior to that. This was, you know, 20 years ago or whatever. He was just waiting. Top particle had been discovered, and he was waiting for the Higgs. Boy, all we need is the Higgs. End of science. We're done if we find the Higgs. And it leads toward that. Where an intermediate solution philosopher is going to say, you know, there's all kinds of that we don't even, there's all kinds of things to answer that we don't even know the questions to ask yet. And there's all kind of answers we have today that are going to be wrong. Okay? So that we're going to find out wrong, or at least there's better answers out there. So which is better? Well, you can kind of hear in my voice that I'm an intermediate solution philosopher, and that's the direction I go. But I still, back in 2005, Tony Lake, who won the 2003 Nobel Prize in Physics, was speaking at UCR. And I actually snuck in early and was the first person there, because they actually turned people in. Place filled up to listen to him talk. I mean, I guess it seated about 300, and there was hundreds of people in line trying to get in after they filled up. Everyone wanted to listen to him talk. And surprisingly so, he just, you know, recently won the Nobel Prize. He didn't speak about his Nobel Prize work at all. He showed up to talk about the philosophy of science, essentially. And I assume, but he didn't use any of these terms. He was just talking about quantum mechanics in general, future quantum mechanics and technology and stuff like that. And I started to realize that he was an intermediate solution philosopher, so I started getting excited. And I also realized something that I believe and fully expect quantum mechanics to fail. Okay? I fully expect that. Because I'm an intermediate solution philosopher, I expect everything to fail. Newton's law of gravity has failed. Okay? It has failed. All right? Einstein's general relativity has replaced it, and it will fail. Okay? And I know several people, by the way, that think it's going to fail soon within our lifetime at general relativity, but not quantum mechanics. That's like the sacred cow. And so when he was done with this talk, he goes to sit down with a couple other UCR faculty members, and they were going to do kind of a panel discussion, but also take questions from the audience. And I was the first person popped up. I just knew what he was talking about. He hadn't used any of those words. And I said, can you tell me if you are an intermediate solution philosopher intermediate solution philosopher, maybe I said traditionalist, or puzzle piece philosopher, and do you expect quantum mechanics to fail? Now, people started snickering. They're like, oh my God, who is this guy? How'd he get in? What an idiot, what a moron, right? Who is this guy? And by the way, I forgot my tag today, so I'm sorry. I didn't just walk in off the street. Actually, I did. I wanted to talk about this. And Tony Leggett then said, let me explain to the audience, because he did use Zane's terminology, let me explain to the audience what intermediate solution philosophy and puzzle piece philosophy is. And then he brought in the word, treasure chest. So he knew exactly what I was talking about. And then he explained what I just explained to you, the audience. And then he said, yes, I expect quantum mechanics to fail. And the place was dead silent. And the two people sitting next to him, the two UCR professors, didn't know what to say. No one knew what to say when he said it fully expected. And then he went a step further and he goes, and it's been more than 10 years now, but he says, we may be at the technological limit to within 10 years we'll be able to test the limits of of quantum mechanics, and we might be able to see, start to see the failure come pretty soon, within a decade. And everyone's super silent. And that proved to me that people are still not Hermes solution. They don't expect quantum mechanics is done. That's a piece of the puzzle. Move on. It's a piece of the puzzle. Don't try to find something to replace it. Move on. Don't try to replace Earth is at the center of the solar system. Move on. You know? Which you know what I'm talking about there with the Copernican model. And so they were so stunned. The other panel members were so stunned that John Baez, who's a mathematical physicist, he was asked to respond to that, and he goes, I'll try to quote him, he goes, I think what our speaker's trying to say. In other words, he didn't like what he said. He was trying to, you know, he was almost embarrassed for the Nobel Prize winner. That why would you say something like that? That crazy, you know? And it just showed that we have not shifted. Majority of scientists, in my anecdotal experience over the years, and I am going to do surveys on this to try to get some quantitative data on this, are still in the mentality of we are a puzzle piece instead of intermediate solution model. I also argue you might have heard the statement, this is paraphrasing, God doesn't roll dice, Einstein saying God doesn't roll dice, and then you might have heard other people like Bohr and stuff say we lost our leader. They were all disappointed in him because he's one of the founders of quantum mechanics, with the photoelectric effect, and yet I think what he was an intermediate solution philosopher. I just think he didn't like the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics. He just thinks there's something better to replace it, and so do I. There's going to be something come along better than quantum mechanics. I don't know what it is, but it's going to be better. So which provides more truth? Which fits your faith better? And you've also heard beauty a couple times in this conference, talk about beauty. That's become the new thing, in particularly among physicists. I've seen the shift from simplicity to beauty. You know, it used to be simplicity is the most important thing in physics, and now beauty, you know, and you even heard our speaker at the banquet night use the word beauty of equations when he talked about the two Nobel Prize winning physicists. They said the one thing we couldn't answer, what did Philip say? He said, beauty, we don't know why the equations look so beautiful. So my question then is, which one actually is more beautiful? Is it more beautiful and does it fit your faith better and your worldview better to be a treasure chest or a puzzle piece philosopher? Or does it fit your faith better to be an intermediate solution? I find both can easily fit both sides. Even though I'm an intermediate solution philosopher, I do find, as far as science goes, there is some intrinsic value in knowing that you found treasure, a final answer, an absolute truth. You know, I'm not a moral relativist, okay? So I have, if there's a piece of the puzzle found, some treasure found, you feel good about it. This is the absolute truth. I have something of truth. I can move on to other things. There's something inherent in that. And you might say, well, intermediate solution philosophy says, hey, that treasure found is going to be devalued at some point because you're going to find something better. So it's not absolute truth, right? And so shouldn't I feel bad about that? And the answer is no. I expect us never get to the absolute truth of everything because we don't have an eternity. And when we get to heaven, we will have an eternity. So I kind of fully expect to keep learning, you know, understanding God's creation better and better and better and better and better and better and better. And eventually we will be, we'll never have. We'll never have the answer. Here on Earth, but and not until eternity in heaven will we come across whatever it means to have the final answer, the final absolute truths, and so forth. So I find both can fit into your philosophy about which is better and truer. But I also kind of feel I think there's a danger. Philosophically, I think there's a danger in puzzle piece mentality because you do move on and you don't ask questions. It's already been solved. And if there is a mistake or there is a better explanation, you've skipped it. You're not even trying to look for it, so you won't find it. But if you assume everything's going to get replaced with something better later, then you have someone still looking at things. You still have someone. I made a deal with God. This might help you out, the deal I made with God. I made a deal with God. I said, before I die, three things have to happen before I die. One, quantum mechanics has to fail. A total repeal and replace. Okay, I just don't want to repeal it. It's got to repeal and replace. Quantum mechanics has to go down and something, and I have to be alive when it gets replaced with. That's one. Two, if aliens exist, and I'm talking about other planets, other supposedly intelligent aliens that communicate with us, I need to be alive at least until we've communicated. So give me that one. So this is where you come in. You're much younger than I am. So if I die, if you go to my Facebook and you watch, and I die, and we've never discovered aliens, you know they don't exist. Because that's the deal I made with God. Okay? But on the other hand, I'm older than you, so you will, that if they do exist, you will know in your lifetime too. So that's good. And then the third thing I picked, I made a deal with God on, that this was the one that's going to keep me alive forever. I mean, much more unlikely than finding aliens. I get to be alive until the Cubs win the World Series. So that was the three I put together, so you can see that one nail's in the coffin now. If you follow baseball, 108 years, and then they win last year. Okay, anybody have any general questions about that?
I was thinking if you're intermediate, that means that there are going to be new models and things that come out. Does that mean, do you think we have the right number of people working on that? Like, is the population of scientists that exists and people think about it enough to be able to, there's more room to grow, I guess. There's a lot more room to grow than if it's just a puzzle piece you're putting together. Oh, this is the last piece. You don't need any more scientists. I mean, are there enough people in the population that are scientists to be able to
So if you're asking if we need more scientists, I would answer yes. That would be great to have more and more people science. And you're right, then it would give more opportunities to go back and look at things that we think are done. I made this argument with, I won't mention his name because you guys all know him, one time about this, that I was this intermediate solution philosophy, and I said, you know, and I gave it as an example. About Newton's laws of gravity falling apart, okay? Which was first discovered essentially with the orbit of Mercury, and that actually is what helped make Einstein's general relativity take off, because Einstein's general relativity matched the orbit of Mercury where Newton's laws of gravity were failing, okay? And it was like a 20-year-old problem or something. It was a long problem, and the physicists kept telling the astronomers, "You're doing your experiments wrong. You're wrong. Go back." You know, because they were only finding the failure in Mercury, not the other planets. And so for like 20 years, astronomers would come back going, there's something wrong with Newton's laws. There's just something wrong here, you know. And it did sound kind of funny 100 years ago when they're saying, when a physicist would ask an astronomer, well, what about the other planets? What about Venus, Earth? Oh, no, those are fine. Those fit with one of our squared law and everything for Newton's laws. Oh, those are fine. It's just Mercury, you know. And of course, you astronomers, you're crazy, something's wrong with you. Mercury's some weird planet that doesn't fit. And then Einstein comes along, and he was actually challenged by an astronomer during World War I, Eddington, and he sent Eddington sent him a letter and said, will you look at the Mercury problem and see if it works with your general relativity? And so Einstein did. He sat down with Max Planck, too, and worked on the Mercury problem. And it was bingo, general relativity matched the orbit of Mercury, matched the data. And so it was like, holy cow, here's a theory that describes gravity that matches all the planets, and you found a planet that is fault, that is. And then he also explained why. You also find out why Newton's laws fall apart, because Mercury's the closest planet, it's in the deepest part of the well, of the space-time continuum well, and so forth. And so space is more curved the closer you get to the sun. The further away they get sent, the flatter it is, and then Newton's laws work well in a more flat space than a curved space. And so so I brought this up, and I said, see, there's a paradigm shift. There's a huge shift. Everyone believed in Newton's laws of gravity. It has failed, and it has been replaced by general relativity. That is a replacement. And his response to me was, "That's tweaking." And I was tweaking, and I said that I don't. And there, and if I say that is not a tweak. It is not a tweak to go from government. And so we had this strong disagreement on that. He called it tweaking.
So I assume it's more complicated than either or, this or that, because I feel like I'm more of a puzzle piece type person, but I don't go all the way to say, oh, science will end here. I'm kind of more of a unveiling a deeper truth. So, for instance, Newtonian gravity is a perfect example. It worked really well, and everyone believed it until, you know, problems such as Mercury's orbit was discovered. But I feel like what Einstein taught us was a deeper truth. Like, he started with the equivalence principle and derived all of gravity and explained everything that Newton did, plus Mercury's orbit, plus, you know, the bending of light. And an even more remarkable part of the theory is that when you work with general relativity and you do a first order approximation, you get Newton's laws. So I would argue that Newton's laws didn't just flat out fail everywhere. I would argue that Einstein revealed a deeper truth.
Right, and I would agree with that because I want to have personally the attitude that everything's gonna fail so that I don't overlook something. But I agree that I'm not 100% on intermediate solution. I love truth. And when it comes to two things you mentioned, one, the bending of light that also came out of general relativity, it was Eddington who sent him the letter about Mercury that then experimentally proved the bending of light for the first time. So Eddington, they never met. This whole letter correspondence. And in fact, it was illegal for Eddington and Einstein to communicate during World War I. And they did it anyway. I mean, Eddington could have been considered a spy or whatever because he was communicating on this problem with Einstein. But it was then in 1919, that's 1 year after World War I was over, Eddington goes to the first solar eclipse that year and takes some pictures and shows and was able to show that starlight was bending. And that actually, that proof of Eddington's, for Einstein's bending of light, that gravity then bends light, is what made Einstein Einstein. That really was the event that made Einstein, when everyone equates Einstein with the genius, that's the event that happened. And if you ever seen that picture with Einstein with his tongue out and his hair all frizzled like this, that came right after that, when all the newspapers wanted to talk to him, because newspapers were literally putting in the paper, Newton dethroned by fellow British citizen, stuff like that. And the Brits were unhappy with Eddington because they just dethroned Newton as the greatest scientist of all time, and they'd given it out to this German who they just fought 4 years with in a war, you know, because he was German. Living in German, Einstein story. So it was not a popular thing. Wrap it up. Okay. And what was their thing? We do need to wrap it up. What was the other thing?
A couple more.
Oh, no, this is it. I just have.
Oh, okay.
No, this is it. So I can. I'm totally
have,
questions.
We still can do 5 more minutes of questions.
Oh, okay. And then what was the other thing you brought up that reminded me? The bending of light, and then. You're right about it's like when Newton's laws don't fail completely, we don't use them. We still use them. In fact, when Apollo 13 was stranded and we had to use a gravity assist to the moon, I very much doubt that NASA was doing general relativity calculations while these people were suffocating from too much carbon dioxide they were exhaling. You know, they would have all died by the time they were done with the calculations to get them home. I'm sure they're using Newton's laws of gravity to get them home. You know, they didn't need that accurate calculations. But on the other hand, I've used my GPS several times in getting here.
Right.
And that uses general relativity, the GPS satellites, you know, to get that kind of accuracy. So yes, we still use Newton's laws of gravity. I was explaining this the other night to someone that asked me this question. I said, you know the equation weight equals mg, right? Weight equals mg. I said, that's an approximation. It's actually referred to as the flat Earth approximation. That's true if the Earth is an infinite flat plane. It's just an approximation. So Newton's laws are very good approximations. So use them where you can. But where they fail, use general relativity. But also, when it comes to understanding of what gravity is, use general relativity. Because Newton's law is action at a distance. And even when Newton came up with his one of our squared law for gravity,
his own colleagues, people that didn't like it. They didn't like this action at distance. Here's the sun, here's the earth. How do they communicate how far apart, how massive they are? This action at distance was troublesome. The only reason why people accepted it is because it fit data. Well, so did the Ptolemaic model fit the data? Better than the Copernican model that said the earth was at the center and planets were on epicycles doing that. When Galileo was going on trial for supporting the Copernican model, at that time, the Copernican model was not the better predictor. The Ptolemaic model did, and that hurt him in his trial. The Ptolemaic model was the better predictor of where Mars would be the next night, the next night, the next night. It was better predictor than the Copernican model at the time. And that hurt him in his trial. So just because the Ptolemaic model was the better predictor doesn't mean it was right. It's fundamentally wrong. It has a fundamental flaw in it. But it does a good job predicting the ocean. It's just wrong. Mars doesn't do this out in space, okay? The sun's at the center. And the reason for the problem was Galileo had never accepted ellipses. Copernicus stayed with circles. Galileo stayed with circles. He knew of Kepler's work that planets actually travel in ellipses. He denied it. No one really knows why. No historian really knows why he never accepted that planets travel in ellipses. And if you take the Copernican model with the Earth center and you don't change from circles to ellipses, the Ptolemaic model is the better predictor. The Ptolemaic model, going clear back to, 140 AD, was the better model.
I would have that question, which provides more truth? I would take issue with that because it seems to me that it's not about truth, because no matter which way you approach it, the data is going to be the data.
Mm-hmm.
It's more about perspective and your walk in life. If you're a puzzle piece person and a paradigm shift comes, you are going to have significant stress because your whole worldview has to change, and that's a very difficult thing to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
If you are a intermediate solutions person and you expect the paradigm shift, it'll be easier in life.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's more about how you accept what we discover in science, because science is just going to be science, and we're not perfect, so we're not going to get it right. It's not about truth, I don't think.
Where I would disagree on that is that I find so many people that say, the people that say quantum mechanics will not fail are not bothering to, what if it does? What if it does fail? What if I'm right and it does fail within my lifetime, hopefully, right? That's the deal I made. And what if it does fail? These individuals, like I said, because they're puzzle beasts, they'll be shocked, but there's something wrong. If Einstein's right and there's something wrong with the probabilistic nature of quantum mechanics and there's a better explanation for it, then the puzzle piece led you to believe this was an absolute truth when it was not an absolute truth. I'll tell you what, Tony, when he responded, when the audience was like dead silent when they heard that he himself expected quantum mechanics to fail, he said, "Now, I'm not saying we're going back." So it's like you go back to, "I'm not saying we're going back, we're going forward. There's something we haven't thought of. There's something completely that no one's come up with. That's what's going to replace it. No going backwards." Because I don't believe the Newtonian world's going to replace the quantum mechanics world. There's a new world we haven't thought of that's going to replace it. And so that's kind of the attitude I try to have. What's new that we haven't thought of yet?
Right, I think we're out of time. Thank you all. Thank you.